As the car disappears into the distance, a cloud of dust eventually settles. Hill waits just a moment more before going for help. Give them some time. It's all going to change now. He'll have to be sure to keep himself in line, say the right things, do what they expect. Time will pass, and soon he will be able to claim his reward. This is True Crime South Africa. I'm Nicole Engelbrecht, and you're listening to episode 179, The Murder of Zahida Ahmed. Holidays are almost here. Head off on your travels and let Ring's wide range of easy-to-install smart home security devices, including security cameras, video doorbells, and alarms, stand guard over your property and valuables while you're away. All devices can be monitored via the Ring app, meaning you can easily confirm all is well simply by checking the live video feed on your phone or smart device. For more information on Ring devices, visit Takealot, Incredible Connection, and Hersh's. Ring, keeping people close to what's important. Since 2019, True Crime South Africa has been telling the stories of the victims of violent crime in South Africa. The podcast is independent. That means no big or even little corporates fund it. And that's just the way I like it. And it's the only independent podcast in South Africa that consistently charts in the top 10. Keeping a podcast like this going is time-consuming. And for the most part, it remains a one-woman process. It's me. I'm the one woman. You? Yes, you. Are the reason this podcast continues to flourish and help bring in tips on missing person and cold cases. If you'd like to help keep the show running, please consider supporting our sponsors, signing up to Patreon or PayPal, follow the show on the socials, as the kids say, and share it with your fellow partners in crime. You can find our social links and learn more about our sponsors at True Crime South Africa. /donate. Shout out to this week's Patreon and PayPal superstars. A huge thank you goes out to Ellis and Yvette Whithead for your support on Patreon. Thank you so much, everyone. Your support really does make a huge difference. Patreon supporters get one additional exclusive episode a month, a shout out on the pod, and other exclusive contents, including Q&As with me, as and when it's available. It's a minimum of $1 a month. I think you should do it. Please. And thank you. Kia ba. This episode was first published as a Patreon-exclusive episode in January 2023. It is updated with some additional information from its original version. The case I'm covering in today's episode happened in the 1990s. But as you'll come to recognise, the type of crime and intimate partner murder has only become more and more prevalent as time has passed. In some ways, I wonder whether the crimes have actually become more prevalent or we're just better at detecting them now. Intimate partner violence wasn't a widely discussed issue in the 90s the way it is now. Of course, it happened all the time, even then, but it was one of those topics that was usually discussed in hushed tones as domestic matters. Until something horrific like a murder happened, and then we couldn't look away. Of course, our understanding of what intimate partner violence actually is has progressed a lot too, and so has the knowledge that police officers and judges have around it. Thankfully, we also have far longer sentences being handed down to perpetrators of this kind of crime, and it's no longer mitigated by claims of a crime of passion. In case you're wondering and you haven't heard me mention this before, the reason that I sometimes revert to the victim's surname previous to their marriage is because I often feel like when a victim is killed by a perpetrator they were married to, the perpetrator should no longer have the honor of the victim carrying their surname. In researching this case, I used several media articles, an episode of Heiskanoot's Vlees en Bloed series, and several court documents. So let's get into episode 179, The Murder of Zahida Ahmed.
The following episode may contain sensitive material, including descriptions of violence, sexual assault, or graphic descriptions of injuries to victims. If you feel you may be triggered by such material, please consider this before accessing our content. To access trauma counseling or services, please see the helpline information on our show notes.
Zahida Ahmed grew up in Louis Trichardt in the Limpopo province of South Africa. She grew up in a loving home with her parents and siblings. The Indian community in Louis Trichardt makes up the third largest part of the town's population, and Zahida was well known and well loved in the community. The Ahmed family was well regarded in the area, with her father, Omar Ahmed, serving as the Northern Province African National Congress legislator for a time. She and her parents were practicing Muslims, and although arranged marriage is often still a part of Muslim tradition, Zahida's parents weren't pushing her to get married when she finished school. They were happy for her to choose her own partner, although it would be understandable that her choice would still be very much guided by the tradition she'd been raised in. Zahida had dreamt of being a doctor from when she was in school, and as soon as she matriculated, this was the path she set off on. When she was 20 years old, and in the midst of her studies, she met the man who would become her husband. Omar Sabadia was 15 years older than Zahida, and he'd moved from India to South Africa in the 80s. He trained and qualified as a psychiatrist in India and set up a practice in South Africa, which he soon decided to niche off to focus predominantly on treating police officers and people who'd experienced accidents at work which had impacted their mental health. Zahida's family was not particularly keen on their young daughter marrying a man 15 years her senior, but they had to admit that he was a good fit for her. Zahida liked the fact that Omar was in the medical profession too. She felt that this would mean he would understand the amount of work she had to put into his studies, and they'd have quite a lot in common. In the years after they got married, Zahida and Omar would have three children together, two girls and one boy. They initially lived in a small apartment in Laudium in Pretoria, but almost overnight, Omar Sabadia's practice seemed to explode in popularity, and he purchased a 3 million rand mansion in Centurion for his family. The property boasted an aviary and a miniature golf course. And at least from the outside, it seemed like the Sabadia family was doing extremely well. Behind closed doors, though, the cracks were showing in Zahida and Omar's relationship. Although Omar gave off the impression of success, and everyone in the community believed his practice was thriving, the opposite was actually true. In 1995, Omar Sabadia had received notification from the main medical aid he billed at his practice that they were starting an investigation into him and his claims, and that they would not be paying out any claims until the investigation was complete. It would emerge that Omar had been billing the police medical aid, PolMed, an average of 600,000 rand a month to treat its police officers. This meant that he'd have to have been seeing 78 officers a day. Clearly, this was impossible, and it's insane that he managed to bill them that way for so long. Omar was telling Zahida that he was working late. This, of course, initially tied up with the fact that his practice was doing so well. He must have had a lot of patients to see, she assumed at first. But soon, it became clear that Omar was not spending these long hours at the office at all. He was visiting casinos. Omar had developed a gambling addiction, and it soon completely destroyed the Sabadia's finances. The fake claims to the medical aid must have been bankrolling that addiction, and when Palmed stopped paying him, the entire sordid situation came to the surface. We don't actually know how much Zahida knew about Omar's financial problems. She definitely knew about his gambling, and she told her parents about that. But it's not clear if she discovered that he was committing fraud as well. When Palmed stopped paying Omar, he took out an additional bond on their home. The bond was worth 1.2 million rand, and by the end of December 1995, there was no sign of that money. When Omar and Zahida had first married, he'd taken out a life insurance policy on her for just over 1 million rand. He had failed to pay the premiums on that policy, though, and it had lapsed. But in 1995, Omar took out a new policy, this time insuring his wife's life for close to 3 million rand. Zahida's father was shocked to hear this. It made no sense because she was still in the process of qualifying and not really bringing in much income into the home at that stage. So there was no reason at all for her life to be insured for such a huge amount. Zahida's father advised her not to sign the policy until Omar was able to give her a valid reason for the huge amount. In January 1996, Zahida and Omar had a huge argument. Zahida could see that Omar was not making any effort to get his gambling addiction under control, and they were falling deeper and deeper into debt. Their three children, then 9, 6, and 4, had to be her first priority, she told her parents. And if their father wasn't going to take responsibility, then she felt she had no other choice but to leave. At this time, it seems Zahida was considering leaving Omar, but still also very much wanted to make her marriage work. She was 30 years old and about to embark on her career as a doctor. She wanted Omar to be a part of that and a part of his children's lives, but she could not stomach his daily deceits and manipulation any longer. As a family following the Muslim faith, in January and February of 1996, the Sabadiyas were observing the holy month of Ramadan. Ramadan is observed by Muslims worldwide as a month of fasting, prayer, reflection, and community. The period during which Ramadan is observed is based on the Muslim lunar calendar, so the dates change every year. In 1996, Ramadan was observed from the 21st of January until the 18th of February. Typically, the fasting element runs from sunrise to sunset each day, so adults will not eat after the sun has risen and will only break their fast when the sun goes down. Zahida loved cooking for her family, and Ramadan was one of her favorite times of the year because she was guaranteed a full table with family and food becoming a real celebration. She was quite health conscious, perhaps understandably, as she was qualifying to be a doctor, and her entire family knew that she detested takeout food. She very rarely ate out, unless it was completely necessary. So on Sunday, the 11th of February, when Omar began to insist that he wanted to go to a nearby Bimbo's restaurant to buy takeaways, Zahida was resistant. She said she would cook for the family later that night, and there was no reason for them to be spending money on takeaways. Omar, though, did not want to hear it. He wanted takeaways, he said. And that, it seemed, was that. Zahida got into the car beside her husband, and they set off for Bimbo's. The couple pulled up to the Bimbo's restaurant near Kharankua just after sunset that night. Omar reversed into a parking spot right in front of the door, and he and Zahida went inside to place their order. After doing so, Omar suggested they wait in the car for their order to be prepared. The owner of the restaurant was standing behind the counter that night and had a direct view of the Sabadia's vehicle as the couple went back outside. The man heard a woman scream and looked up. He watched as three armed men forced the couple into their vehicle, Omar in the driver's seat and Zahida in the back. It's unknown as to whether the owners of the Bimbos actually called police at that point. I would assume he would, but a taxi driver did see the scene unfolding and gave chase. The man said that the vehicle actually drove quite slowly at first, and he was able to keep up with them easily. Soon, though, they seemed to realize they were being followed, and somewhere on the road to Rustenburg, he lost them. The taxi driver drove straight to the closest police station and reported what he'd seen. I would guess that at this point, it would actually be quite difficult for police to really do anything. They would have a description of the vehicle, and if the taxi driver had managed to get the registration number, they could have put out an alert and maybe figured out who the owner of the vehicle was. But we don't know if this happened, and the only real action seemed to happen hours later. Omar Sabadia would later tell police that the hijackers had forced him to drive to a rural area and then pulled him out of the car. They'd beaten him and stabbed him and left him on the side of the road. They drove away with Zahida in the car. Omar walked what he claimed was close to 10 kilometers, but instead of going to Kharankua Hospital, which was much closer to the location he alleged he was dropped off at, Omar walked all the way back to the Bimbo's restaurant, and at 2 a.m. on the 12th of February, the man, bloodied and bruised, hammered on the door of the house opposite the Bimbo's restaurant. The shocked occupants of the house took Omar to the hospital, and staff there called the police. One family member would later say that they were called in the early hours of the morning to say that Omar was in the hospital, bleeding profusely from his stab wounds. When they arrived at the hospital, though, they found that he was not nearly as badly injured as had been indicated. In fact, a doctor would later describe his stab wounds as superficial, with little more than the skin having been pierced. When police arrived, Omar explained that he and his wife had been hijacked and his wife had been taken. Police immediately set out to search the area where Omar said he'd been dropped off and put out an alert for the Sabadia's vehicle with Zahida, also registered as a missing person. Zahida's family immediately came to Pretoria from Louis Trichardt when they heard that she'd been taken. At first, the hope was that she'd simply been taken for a ransom and that she could be safely recovered. But it didn't seem to make sense that kidnappers would take Zahida and release Omar, when they could get a far higher ransom for two people than just one. Zahida and Omar's community got behind the search immediately, and posters were distributed across Pretoria and Johannesburg. The media quickly picked up on the story of the beautiful young budding doctor whose three young children and husband were now desperately searching for her. Omar spoke to journalists, begging the kidnappers to return his wife and insisting he would pay everything he had to get her back. This may have seemed a generous commitment to those who were looking at the Sabadia's lifestyle from the outside, but for a few very close to the couple, they knew it was pretty much a worthless offer. Omar Sabadia did not have any money to pay for a ransom. Certainly, his wife's family would likely have done everything they could to get a ransom together if necessary, but no ransom demand ever came. And as the days went by with no news and no leads, those who loved Zahida became more and more concerned that she was at great risk. This concern only grew when a few days after the hijacking, Omar's car was found abandoned near a railway line. There was blood in the vehicle, but there was no sign of Zahida. 2 weeks after Zahida went missing, her parents decided to hire a private investigator. The man they hired was no stranger to crime. Slung Fansale had been a police officer for many years, until in 1988, he'd resigned to join the South African Defence Force's notorious Civil Cooperation Bureau, which would later be revealed was essentially an assassination and dirty trick squad for the apartheid government. He was joined in his investigation by Jack LaGrange, a former head of Brixton Murder and Robbery, who'd served time for killing two drug dealers. These two had been tasked with replicating the police's investigation to ensure that nothing had been missed. Their first port of call was Omar Sabadia. The man provided them with a fresh statement about the events that had occurred on the night of the hijacking, and Fansale says that immediately it didn't sit right with him. When they spoke to the doctor who treated Omar for his stab wounds, the man said that not only were the wounds superficial, but he actually felt like they could have been self-inflicted. Then the PIs went to the scene of the crime. The first thing that stood out to them there was the owner of the restaurant recalling that Omar had reverse parked his vehicle. The man recalled how Omar had gone to great lengths to ensure he reverse parked into the parking lot in front of the shop. None of the other cars were reverse parked, and when Fansale visited Omar at other venues, like his house and office, his car was never reverse parked. So it wasn't like it was just a habit for him. In fact, that instance of reverse parking seemed completely out of the norm. Of course, reverse parking is a very good way to ensure you have a quick getaway out of a parking spot if you're in a hurry. After visiting Bimbo's, Fansale went next door to the petrol station, which shared a parking lot with the restaurant. He figured that there was just as good a chance that someone had seen the incident that day there or spotted the perpetrators arriving. The PI struck gold. One of the employees at the petrol station said that on the day of the hijacking, shortly before Omar and Zahida had pulled into the parking lot, a man had come into the petrol station and described a car, asking if the employee had seen that car pull into the parking lot yet. The employee told the man he didn't remember such a car, and he'd left. But less than half an hour later, a car fitting that exact description had pulled into the parking lot and reverse parked into a spot in front of the Bimbos. The man said it was that car that had been hijacked that day. Alarm bells went off in Fansale's head. This had clearly not been a random hijacking. Someone had known that Omar's car was going to be there that evening, and considering Omar claimed the takeaway suggestion had been spur of the moment, how was it possible that anyone could have known if Omar himself had not informed them? There's a significant amount of confusion about whether the anonymous tip that led to the crescendo of this case had actually come into the PIs or the police. But either way, while Fansale was connecting the dots back to Omar Sabadia, an anonymous tip was coming in from a man who'd once had a conversation he now believed was vitally important to this case. The anonymous caller said that he'd been approached in January 1996 by a man he knew as Patrick. Patrick had said he was looking for someone to carry out a hit on behalf of his doctor. The caller said he'd declined, but he had referred Patrick to two other men. Another part of this investigation that remains up in the air is how exactly Omar Sabadia came to be arrested and questioned. Some sources say that when Patrick, this alleged middleman, was located He gave up Omar as the mastermind behind the plot, but other sources say that Omar did himself in. However Omar Sabadia came to be in police custody, on the night he was arrested, the entire community, and certainly Zahida's family, were in complete shock. No one had ever suspected that Omar could be involved in his wife's disappearance. During an interview with police, Omar provided a full confession. He admitted that he had hired a patient, Patrick Manyapi, to find two other men to stage a hijacking and abduct his wife. He admitted that Zahida was no longer alive. Omar would later lead police to the general area where he knew Zahida's body had been left, and scent dogs would make the final grisly discovery. By the time the remains of 30-year-old Zahida Ahmed were discovered, she'd been missing for 22 days in the heat of the South African summer. She was significantly decomposed. Her belongings were scattered around her body, and she'd been tied to a tree using a rain jacket. Initial identification was made by the clothing she was wearing, as well as her hair, but a formal identification through dental impressions would later confirm that the remains did indeed belong to Zahida. The Ahmed family were aghast. Not only was their beautiful, talented, and loving daughter dead, but now it seemed it had been her husband who'd orchestrated the entire thing. After Omar's arrest, Zahida's father began to put two and two together. He remembered Zahida's concerns about her husband's financial situation and that enormous life policy he'd warned her not to sign. It suddenly seemed as clear as day that Omar Sabadia had killed his wife, predominantly to get the life insurance money, and perhaps also because she planned to leave him, and he would have likely needed to pay maintenance for his children. In the days after Omar's arrest, as headlines screamed about the dodgy doctor and his deceptive dealings, more arrests were made. Patrick Manyapi was arrested. It emerged that the man had been a patient of Omar's since 1991, when he'd fallen from a roof at a construction site and sustained a head injury, which had resulted in mental health issues. Omar had been treating him, and Patrick would later claim, simultaneously, brainwashing him. He said that he'd eventually felt as though Omar held his sanity in his hands, and he'd had such respect for the doctor that when he started telling him in sessions about problems he was having with his wife, Patrick's hatred for the woman began to fester. The young man had no reason to doubt his psychiatrist when he told him that Zahida was being unfaithful, that she was spending all of their money and bankrupting him, and that Omar was fearful she may be planning to have him killed so that she could be with her lover. Of course, Zahida was none of these things. She had never been unfaithful to Omar, and she certainly hadn't been the reason for his financial woes. He'd managed that all on his own. But, Patrick said, Omar had dropped these pieces of information into his sessions like little breadcrumbs, building on them over time until Patrick was entirely convinced that his doctor was under attack by this horrific woman. And then the suggestion was made. There was only one way to solve this problem forever. Omar said Zahida had to die. Sir Patrick had approached a neighbour he thought might be interested. This had been the anonymous caller. When that man turned down the job, he referred Patrick to two others. Those two men, Albert Muketsani and Richard Malema, had agreed to do the job for 70,000 rand. When Patrick had reported back to Omar, the doctor had apparently laughed and said he would pay 170,000 rand for the job to be done. And so it was that the three men had arranged a firearm and then awaited instructions from Omar. They'd gotten the word a few days before the 11th, and on the night in question, they were ready to pounce in the parking lot of Bimbo's. The men would later confess to having dropped Omar off at the location he'd requested and then driving further on with Zahida. They said she'd had no idea that her husband was involved in the plot to kill her. Near the place where her body was found, they'd pulled off the road and forced her to walk into the dense bush. Then, when they were sure they were far enough in, they'd strangled her to death with the rain jacket that was found tied around her throat and then tied to the tree. At the first court appearance for all four accused, hundreds of people turned up to protest outside the courthouse. All four declined to apply for bail, as they simply didn't think they would be safe outside of prison walls. The community was that outraged at the senseless and cold-hearted murder. When the trial began, the location would be moved further into Pretoria and away from where Zahida had lived to try and prevent further protest action from taking place. All four accused pleaded not guilty to all the charges against them. Although all four had given confessions to some level of involvement, and Omar had even led police to Zahida's body, they all attempted to retract their confessions in court, claiming they'd been assaulted and forced to make confessions. The trial continued for several weeks and dominated media headlines for most of that time. During the trial, it was revealed that Omar had told Zahida he wanted to leave the country to get away from his financial problems, but she was understandably not willing to accompany him. The man had done absolutely nothing to earn Zahida's trust. He'd done nothing but lie to her throughout their marriage. She'd worked hard to get as close as she was to qualifying to practice medicine, and she wasn't going to throw that away, as well as her family ties and her children's future, to flee with her criminal husband. It's very likely that Omar's plan all along was to use the money from Zahida's life insurance to leave South Africa. It's also very likely he wouldn't have taken his children with him. In late 1996, all four defendants were found guilty of all charges against them. In mitigation, Omar revealed that he'd been diagnosed with bipolar disorder several years before, and when he was in manic phases, he claimed his behaviour was unpredictable. This, he said, had resulted in his gambling addiction, as well as what he framed as a desperate attempt to avoid his life crashing down around him. He did not at any point express remorse for the pain he'd caused his children or Zahida's family. In sentencing the four accused, the judge remarked that the crime was one of the most callous he'd seen in a very long time. The sentences were, of course, passed prior to the Minimum Sentences Act, so sentence structures were different than they would be today. The judge sentenced Omar Sabadia to 50 years in prison. He said that he should serve a minimum of 35 years before being considered for parole. Albert Muketsani was sentenced to 40 years, and Richard Malema and Patrick Manyape to 25 years imprisonment each. Patrick was able to successfully appeal his sentence down to 15 years, as the appeal court agreed that the sentencing judge should have taken into account the position of power and control that Omar Sabadia had had over Patrick in his role as his psychiatrist. When Zahida's class graduated with their doctorates, Zahida Ahmed was granted an honorary doctorate, and her family received this on her behalf. The title she'd worked so hard to be able to bear was now hers to use, but thanks to Omar Sabadia, she would never have the pleasure of uttering the words, Dr. Zahida Ahmed. You may have noticed that throughout this episode, I've referred to Zahida by her maiden name, Ahmed, instead of Sabadia, Omar's surname. I've done this for two reasons. Firstly, Omar Sabadia, lost the privilege of having Zahida bear his surname when he decided that comforts and image were worth more than her life. Secondly, Zahida's three children grew up with their maternal grandparents, and all three dropped their father's surname. They all identify as Ahmed now, and so I think it's only fitting that Zahida be identified that way too. Zahida's children lost both their parents in a very short space of time, but they say that growing up in the loving and stable household with their grandparents made a huge difference. All three children decided very early on that they wanted nothing to do with their father. None of them visited him in prison. In 2007, Patrick Manyape was released on parole. 2 years later, Richard Malema joined him on the outside. And then, in 2018, the Ahmed family were shocked to discover that Omar was being considered for parole. The family appealed against the consideration, stating that the judge had clearly said that Omar should serve at least 35 years before being considered for parole. But the Department of Correctional Services would find that because the ruling was made prior to 2004, when the Funvac judgments altered the minimum period that offenders must serve before being eligible for parole, it was no longer valid. In most cases, actually, a judge's determination around how much time must be served before parole does not translate into actual action by the DCS, because they are two different departments that don't have jurisdiction over one another. Omar was granted a parole hearing and his children attended. This was the first time they'd seen their father since the day he was arrested for their mother's murder. They said he did not make eye contact with them, attempt to apologize, or show any form of emotion or remorse. He continued to claim he'd simply been a victim of circumstances and his own mental health issues. On this first occasion, Omar was not granted parole. But not long after, he once again appeared before the parole board. On this occasion, the Ahmed family were not made aware that he'd appeared until they received notification that a date had been set for Omar's release. They once again attempted to stall the process and stop him from getting parole. But in October 2019, Omar Sabadia was released. He moved to Zanin and had no contact with his children. In September 2023, after just 4 years out on parole, at the age of 72, Omar Sabadia passed away after what is described as a short illness. In spite of their very difficult beginnings, Zahida's children thrived and pushed forward. Her two daughters obtained LLB degrees and started their own businesses, and her son studied finance. They are not only a testament to their grandparents and the love and care they received from them growing up, but also to their mother. The older girls still have a few memories of their mother they hold dear, and they say that while they don't let anger hold them back or eat them up inside, they will never forgive their father for what he stole from them. In fact, they say, as far as they're concerned, he is not their father. The only true father figure they've ever known is their grandfather, and they've felt privileged to be raised in the same way and with the same love that their mother was. Although Zahida did not get the chance to raise her children herself, in some way, the love that she would have given them was replicated through them growing up with her parents. That, of course, will never replace the deep hole that their biological father created in their lives, though. I cannot even imagine the fear that Zahida Ahmed must have experienced in the minutes before her death. Her killers would claim that she had no idea her husband was involved, but I wonder about that. Zahida was an intelligent and intuitive woman. she had already started to see through her husband's deception, and I have to wonder whether that night, as Omar got out on the side of the road and the car drove away with Zahida in it, perhaps she'd look back at him through the back window, having perhaps just an inkling that the man who'd vowed to love and protect her and who had instead hurt and betrayed her had just committed the greatest and most unforgivable deception of all. Dr. Zahida Ahmed, rest gently. If you'd like to hear more victim-focused true crime content, please subscribe to True Crime South Africa on Spotify or the platform you're using to listen right now. If you're looking for something still related to real-life stories, but often with a more positive slant, you can check out my new podcast series, I Live Through This. You can follow both podcasts on social media. We're on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. I'll be back next week with another episode. Until then, thank you for your support, and I'll chat to you soon.